Welcome to Fireside Chats, Leadership Journeys, brought to you by the Office of Academic Clinical Affairs and hosted by Dr. Carolyn Porta. These chats bring together University of Minnesota Health Sciences students with experts for candid conversation on leadership, career pathways, sources of joy, and strategies to rejuvenate.
Good evening and welcome to our Fireside Chat, the final one of our academic 21-22 year. I'm delighted to have some guests today with us from the Senate and from mHealth Fairview. I'm Carolyn Porta. I serve as an Associate Vice President for Clinical Affairs here at the University of Minnesota. I'm a forensic nurse clinician and a professor also here in the School of Nursing. I'll ask my guests to briefly introduce themselves, and then we'll dive into some candid conversation and see where we go. I'll start with Senator Tina Smith. Welcome. Would love to hear a little bit about you, how you got to where you are, and something that brings you joy these days.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Carolyn, and to everybody else on this call. It's nice to be able to join you. I join you from my apartment in Washington, D.C. after a busy day and a busy springy day here in Washington. I've been a United States Senator from Minnesota since 2018, and I serve on the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, and also on the Agriculture Committee, and Indian Affairs, and Banking Housing. And in really all of those committees, I have a chance to talk about health and to think about health, and especially to think about the social determinants of health and what we need to do to think holistically about helping people to have everything that they need to lead healthy lives. So it's really wonderful to have a chance to visit with you all, and I look forward to the conversation.
Thank you so much. And Dr. Laura Reed, who is our Chief Nursing Officer and Chief Operating Officer for mHealth Fairview.
Thanks, Carolyn. Really wonderful to be here tonight and to be able to have the chance to visit with you and share stories of what has made our careers meaningful and how we make a difference in the communities we serve. Really looking forward to it. I've been a nurse for over 43 years. And it is truly the best part of my life, and really dedicated to the nursing profession, and have learned a lot also in the COO role. So really excited to have a chance to visit.
Thank you. And then Dr. Mark Welton, our Chief Medical Officer for mHealth Fairview, if you would introduce yourself.
Sure. Good evening, everybody. Glad to meet you virtually. I'm Mark Welton. I'm a colorectal surgeon by training. Spent my first 25 years of my career in academic surgery in California, UCSF and Stanford, and then got into some administration roles there, running the cancer center and then running the hospital as the chief of staff, and then was enticed to come out here and join our CEO, James Hereford, who was the COO at Stanford when I was there, came out here to join him because he always had the attitude of, let's explore the art of the possible, which in healthcare is really what we do every single day, because it's who knew that healthcare was so complicated, as some people have said, and it is very complicated. So I had the joy of working with the COO, CNE, Dr. Laura Reed on a daily basis, and we spend a lot of time trying to explore the art of the possible, try to improve healthcare delivery in the Twin Cities metro and across Minnesota, Western Wisconsin, Iowa, and North and South Dakota. So it's a lot of fun, a lot of the time, sometimes a little frustrating.
Well, thank you for being here, all of you. And I'll probably dive right into a few more just challenging questions. You just said sometimes it's frustrating. I worked with a student group in Africa a few years ago, and they had to design a t-shirt for their club, their One Health student club, which was interprofessional animal health, human health, and environmental health students. And on the back of their t-shirt, they wrote, "Without health, you have nothing." And it was their tagline. They walked around, they promoted community health in their student learning experiences. I still remember it because, of course, without health, what do we have when we're feeling sick, when we're living with intense pain or even just dull chronic pain? Life is not what it could be. Mental health, when we don't have good good mental health, good emotional well-being, we're also struggling to get through a day, to accomplish, to contribute, to feel at peace. So I would just open the floor up to all of you. I know you're passionate about solving our mental health crisis, about supporting the full well-being of humans in our society. I also know that we don't do that in a bubble. We live in a society that has stressors, strains, protective factors, risk factors at the micro level, at the macro level. So I welcome just initial thoughts and ideas from the policymaking perspective, from the healthcare system perspective, where you care about the communities that you are serving. How are we tackling? What are we doing or not doing to support the mental health of our society?
Well, maybe I'll jump in. I really appreciate that question. And, you know, it makes me think that you asked me a question, Carolyn, about what I do to bring joy in my life. And I was thinking, of course, immediately about my little grandchildren, who I have a chance to see almost every week. And I think that that reminds me of the power of connection and social cohesion as a way of keeping us physically and mentally healthy. It also makes me think, and I'd be super interested to hear what the clinicians on the healthcare side think about this. But when it comes to mental health, I think too often we have thought about mental health as sort of one silo and then physical health as the other silo, and we don't connect them enough. And in fact, of course, it's one person, one body, one whole health challenge, and the two sides, mental and physical health, need to be integrated so much more in order for us to be able to truly take care of people's whole health. So that is a lot of what I am working on from a public policy perspective, how to encourage that kind of connectivity and cohesion. And then also how to think about our mental health needs across the whole continuum that we have, from early, from prevention and early identification, all the way through to what might be a crisis situation for an individual or a need for long-term chronic healthcare care. And I think that we have to do a much better job of working all along that continuum, trying to keep people at the one end, the lower end of the continuum, I would say. And I think that one of the best ways of doing that is by linking up whole, physical health and mental health at the very earliest. Laura, I think you said you were experience in pediatrics, and one of the things I'm trying to figure out is how to get better care early on in kids' lives so that we know if there's a need that it's met sooner rather than later.
No, that's great. I'll jump in, and certainly, from a policy perspective, there's nothing more important that as a health professional, that we are advocating for the things that really matter to the people who are impacted by mental health issues. And part of that is understanding, what their access to care is, understanding what their access is to, as Tina described, the preventative care options so that we can keep people healthy and have a sense of well-being and confidence in their day. And, and that health systems that take on some of these difficult challenges, that they also have the ability to have adequate reimbursement for the care being delivered. And, from my perspective, one of the most amazing things that we have done, Dr. Welton and I with others in our mental health service line, is offered the opportunity to try what is wrong with our care model. We wait for people to come to an ED. We wait for people to come to, a situation where they are in crisis. And then we worry that we don't have enough inpatient beds. So how can we really think about it differently, not only from primary care and integrated behavioral health or mental health with primary care, but that we also offer other options. And our empath unit that we started in Southdale and are now, you know, really considering expansion of, you know, how do we help people that if they do come in crisis, that we can stabilize them, we can support them, we can offer intervention, you know, in that moment of crisis, but in 24 to 48 hours, they're safe to go back to their home or back with their loved ones and then have additional outpatient treatment as needed. That is so much better than an admission into an inpatient unit. Those care model changes are really necessary for all of us to kind of like understand what's the clinical implications for that and how do we continue to measure what are the outcomes related to that and what's the cost in really decreasing our total cost of care. So lots of really passionate issues around mental health, and given what we've all gone through for the last 2 years, it's devastating to see the impact that it's had on our people and our communities and in our schools. So I do think it's an ongoing important topic that we keep challenging ourselves with and trying to address.
Yeah, and I'll just add that, as Laura pointed out, the last place, if you think about your personal experience in an ED, if you've ever had to be in one, that's the last place in the world you'd ever want to put somebody who's in a mental health crisis. It's loud, it's chaotic, it's confusing, it's disorienting. Windows aren't there, you know. So you take somebody who's in a crisis and you say, oh, go to the ED. No, don't go to the ED. Go to some place that you can de-escalate, some place that's calming. That's what the Empath Unit at Southdale does. And that's why we're spreading that. But as Laura highlighted, we don't have a mechanism, although we're delivering the proper care and the best care and innovative care, we don't have a mechanism to get paid for that because it's not an established model. So there's no way to be compensated for that care. We continue to do it and we continue to talk to the payers about it, but we need to figure that out because it's improving the health of our community and helping these patients. But the other side of it too, that since we talked about the mental health piece, we're only talking about half of it. The other half is the impact on the providers. The crisis is at such a scale that people are having a crisis themselves because they realize they're not delivering the kind of care that they were trained to deliver. And because the systems are overwhelmed, they're doing outstanding work and the best that they possibly can, but they still feel bad at the end of the day. And so they are having mental health issues as well. And sort of that moral challenge around, okay, I'm trying to deliver care and I'm gonna do the best I can, but it's not really the best that I know that I could be delivering in another situation. And so that's why our systems are really feeling it, both from the patients overwhelming the system and then the providers going, you know, we go into healthcare because we have the disease that is, we get joy out of taking care of people. And part of that is to then feel good about what you did at the end of the day, go home exhausted, but feel good about it. Right now, that feeling good about it is a bit of a gap that our, I shouldn't say a bit of a gap. Some of our people are really feeling a significant gap and other people aren't feeling it quite as heavily, but we need to focus on that too, because we're gonna lose nurses and doctors unless we address this more rigorously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. I'm going to come back to that, Mark, and this concept of compassion fatigue and moral distress and self-care. This generation of healthcare providers, and really the last couple of generations, has never had to deal with deficits in healthcare delivery in many parts of the country. That is not true everywhere. It's not even true in our rural communities, but for many, having shortage of a supply is new. They don't even know what to do with that, right? So the wrestle and the struggle is very real. Senator Smith, I know that we only have a few minutes of your time. I'm wondering if you want to offer any reflections as you think about the legislative role in overcoming some of these challenges. And knowing that some of these interns and the folks that will listen to this recording later, they are moving into public health roles, healthcare administration roles, policy roles. They're working in the safety net FQHCs of our community. So, you know, we're on that front line, if you will. But we need relationship, obviously, with the legislative policymakers. I'm sure you might have some thoughts about that.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, there's a lot there. And I guess I'll start by saying that, I'm grateful that now that I'm in the United States Senate in this point in my life, that I have had the opportunity to work a lot closer to the work in other parts of my career and my professional life. So, you know, I worked at a nonprofit that delivered healthcare to men and women, especially those who were struggling to afford it. I worked at the local level for the city of Minneapolis and then at the state level, and I had an opportunity to work closely with some excellent, excellent public health professionals like Gretchen Musikant, for example, at the city of Minneapolis. And the reason I think that that is important is because I truly believe that the best ideas for how to make things work better are going to come from people who are doing the work. And it is easy to become sort of analytical and way above the fray when you're not that close to the challenges that people are dealing with every single day. That, I think, is my, I guess in a way, that's sort of my secret sauce of being in the Senate, where, you know, I keep that connection to the kind of the grassroots, I guess I would say, especially in healthcare. You know, the other thing I would say is, and you mentioned this at the beginning, Carolyn, is that, you know, healthcare, what's working with healthcare in our country and what is not working in our country with healthcare is extremely complicated. I once worked with, well, one of my favorite people, Mark Dayton, who used to say for every complicated question, there's a simple answer that's almost always wrong. And I think that that is very true when it comes to the complexities of how to make healthcare work better. Yes, of course, just as an example, yes, of course, we have pricing problems, we've got cost problems, we've got access problems. But I tend to think more and more that our biggest challenges are around trying to do the kind of integrated care that I know, that Laura and Mark were just talking about, because that is what makes people, that is really how you get to the health that you were describing at the very beginning, Caroline. The other thing I would say, for those of you that are thinking about going to work in the public sphere and public policy, is just how much we need you. I think that I'm always an optimist. I am looking for the kind of where the tipping point is and making the changes that we need to make. And I believe we need to make a lot of changes. I believe that emerging from this once in 100 years global pandemic, that we actually are at a tipping point for making really the kinds of substantial change that we need to make, because the pandemic has laid bare so many of the deep inequities and challenges in our healthcare system that results in the dramatic differences that Black and Brown and Indigenous people experience, people low income people experience compared to others in our country. And that's an opportunity for us to kind of make the changes that we need. And that's why we need young leaders, new leaders who are not so, you know, who are prepared to challenge the status quo and come up with the new ideas that we need so much. So I actually think that this is a time of great opportunity. Yeah, I mean, the challenges are so deep. And Mark, I appreciate so much what you were saying about the kind of the crisis of healthcare providers because of the deep stresses and pressures that you all have been going through. That, as you said, Laura, the first time that so many people have dealt with the fact that we live in, you know, the wealthiest country in the world, we spend more on healthcare than anybody else, and yet we still see these gaps in care and services and supplies that we're just not really prepared for. So certainly there are real challenges here, but I think that this is a moment where we can kind of pivot to what do we need to do differently? What different things do we need to do that we've learned from this experience? And that's why all of us are really needed right now.
Thank you, Senator Smith. Anytime you need some stories from those of us on the front line working with patients, you know where to find us. And these interns, if they're anything, they are disruptors and willing to offer you a different way of looking at the problems and the issues. So I will volunteer all of them to your service. And again, thank you wholeheartedly for being here and for the work that you're doing. Do you have time to recommend any books or podcasts or music that you love and enjoy?
Oh my goodness. Let's see. Well, so I'm going to recommend a book that is actually a very old book and let me just say, first of all, I'm like a keen believer in pure, like, escapist reading. I think that it is how I survive the long days as I go to bed, and I am not reading something serious. I am reading some ridiculous, mystery, or preferably set in some faraway place that's really beautiful. But in the name of how we need to bring creativity and innovation and even a little bit of improvisation to our work right now, I'm going to recommend to all of you a book that made a real difference in my life when I was in my early 30s. It's a book called Composing a Life by an author named Mary Catherine Basin. She's actually the daughter of Margaret Mead. She did a whole series of interviews with five highly creative, successful women to understand how they thought about their lives and how they balanced their lives. And she came up with this just incredibly interesting, rich story about what these women did. The through line was how they all learned to be improvisational in their lives in order to make the most of the material that they had at hand. Improvisation meaning how to take what you have and turn it, build it into something that, not improvisation as in just sort of making it up as you go along and whatever works, works. And that was a really, that was very inspirational to me when I was in my younger life and trying to figure out what the hell I was doing. And I recommend it to everybody for to give you an idea of the power of improvisation as you think about your life and your career.
Thank you. I love it. And I know quite a few people will be probably thinking about reading that one. Thanks for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you all. Thanks for all of your work. Bye-bye.
Thank you. So let's go with that question, Laura and Mark, since we're on it. Any recommended books, podcasts, music, movies? We maintain a list of suggestions, and I know a lot of people are accessing those.
Are you waiting for me, Laura? So I'll jump in with books first. I just read three books by over a little while now by a guy named, I think it's John Towles, T-O-W-L-E-S. The last one was Lincoln Highway. And then before that is A Gentleman in Moscow, and then something about etiquette, something. But if you find the other two, you'll find that. I just really enjoy the way he turns a phrase and the way he animates what he's describing in a very auditory and visual way that I find entertaining. And he also postulates things that I haven't thought about before through his characters that I really enjoy. So that would be, I'm reading a less exciting book right now. It's The Unforgiving Sky is what it's called. And it's about the Donner Party. And I'm a Californian, and it's an interesting history. And then I don't listen to a lot of, you talked about the Twitter, and I don't really do that. I try to stay off that. I'm just sort of an NPR PBS kind of person. I rely on NPR and PBS. And if you talk about music, I listen to almost any kind of jazz. And then what my kids try to introduce me to, I guess.
Thank you. Laura.
That's awesome. Well, yeah. I loved it that Tina started off her comments by saying, I do something when I read or when I listen to music or podcasts, it is like to totally allow my mind to reset and really take a break and think about something totally different than what I'm doing every day, except when I was getting my DMP. Then, you know what, my whole time was all about that.
Yes.
I just recently read a book that I would highly recommend. It's not necessarily a new book, but we did it as part of a book club, and it was called Talking to Strangers by Malcolm Gladwell. I'm sure many of you are familiar with him. And the reason I did it as a podcast, because the book itself was kind of dry for me to just read, but I absolutely loved the audio. And it felt so relevant for our times right now, related to like how do we interact with people that we don't know? Mm-hmm. How do we approach people, you know, with, you know, trust and a lack of bias and really just see them and listen to them for where they are in their life. And it also talked about a lot of the foibles of, you know, we have a lot of implicit biases anyway. And so when you see someone, you think of it a certain way and how that clouds your ability to really kind of love and trust them as a stranger. Although as a society, we do tend to give an abundance of support to people, even that we don't know, and that we trust that they are very well intended. And it just played both sides of it so well that you could really see how it's played out in some of what we're experiencing related to racism, related to understanding why we're at war right now over in Ukraine, and just a number of really important issues. So I would highly recommend it. It was really fun to talk about it with a group of really smart young people and be able to learn a little bit more about myself and about how other people viewed it. So it was fun.
Thank you, Laura. I'm going to invite the interns to go ahead and use the chat box if you want to add any additional questions. I have a few more just to engage your perspectives and your thoughts. I want to circle back on provider, clinician, frontline worker care. And certainly if you are in Twitter world, and it's okay if you're not, Mark, we see the onslaught of people reflecting personally on themselves and certainly on the system and on their coworkers. And I have to say, there are times when I go into the hospital to take care of a patient, and as a forensic nurse, I only go in when there's a need for my services. And my colleagues, the ED staff around me, they're having a great day. And I look around and I think, where's the moral distress? Where's the compassion fatigue? And then of course there are other days and people are short and uptight and you can't find anyone willing to help you with anything. And of course we have a lot more of those days than we would want. At the same time, we're cynical and we are not feeling like the systems around us are doing enough to support us. And as leaders, I know you feel that pressure, and you feel the pressure personally, as well as the pressure of the system. So I know that in the last couple of years, you've had to have travelers, for example, in numbers that you hadn't needed probably in the decade previous. And that has posed some challenges as well for some of the professions. So any reflections from your perspective as a system leader on how we get through this season? How about that? And how we welcome these new young professionals into a system that is very, very challenged right now.
Yeah. You know, I'll start, but honestly, having a dyad partner is very helpful as a healthcare leader right now. So knowing that Mark and I can take each other's strengths and opportunities and really help approach problem solving, engage in more active listening, and really be present. When Tina talked about one of her secret sauces, she talked about, you know, being in the work. And when I think about what's going to be necessary for us to be a compelling, thoughtful, loving healthcare system that's going to help people feel confident about moving forward, it is going to be all about how we show up and be in the work. It isn't about sitting in meetings and thinking about policy. We have to do that. There's no doubt about it. And we have to make the best decisions that we can with the information we have. But what really matters is how well we're able to actively listen to the teams. And so, Carolyn, the other day I walked through the ED on West Bank that's been having, you know, lots of challenges, but it's everywhere. And it was a glorious day. And I kept thinking to myself, okay, I'm kind of relieved. And yet, you know what? It's just as important for me to be on the days that are really, really horrible too. And I think that's what Mark and I try to do together is we need to create a very compelling picture of how this is an opportunity for us as healthcare leaders to make a difference that we've never been able to do before. Because we've had so much learning, so much crisis, and we've also had a lot of growth in thinking about how we apply research, a lot of growth in how we apply clinical protocols, how we develop protocols quickly and yet thoughtfully. I mean, it has been an amazing 2 years, if you really think about it. But instilling that sense of hope, confidence, and vision, that's the work. That is the work for all of us, whether we're in public policy, whether we're a student, it doesn't matter where we're at. And it's believing in our professional education system that we, along with people who are actually in the work, can help create that energy and synergy about what is possible. What can we do over the next 10 years to really make an amazing difference for the people and generations to come? So it's going to be a slog a little bit because we can't be everywhere, but it is really important that people feel heard and they feel your presence in a way that's authentic and not just a bunch of garbly goo. So on that scientific note, I'll throw it over to Dr. Welton.
Yeah, I guess a couple of things. I do think that when Laura and I are out rounding, we're taking the opportunity to thank the people that have stayed through this, first and foremost. Because one thing that's been unique about this is it's not just the stress of work. Work is work. It's that you can't get away from it. So I lived through the AIDS epidemic in the late 80s, early 90s in San Francisco, when the Castro went from this party 24/7, it was a circus. It was so vibrant. It was so alive. It was so amazing. And it then went to a morgue. Everybody was dying, and everybody, you turn left and right and you'd see somebody that you knew and somebody died, and it was horrible. And I was taking care of HIV positive men who have sex with men. That was a large part of my practice. And so there's a lot of controversy at the time around whether or not you were risking your health in doing that, and people very vocal. Orthopedic surgeon at San Francisco General, and a lot of discussion around that. And yet, I personally might have been taking some risks as a surgeon that I would try to control and manage, but I didn't bring it home. And it wasn't at home. It wasn't in the supermarket. It wasn't in the schools the way this pandemic has been. So people have been stressed, yes, by delivering healthcare at the beginning of the pandemic to people they didn't really understand the disease. And oh, there was stress associated with that. Am I risking my life? Am I risking my family's life? As we learned more, it spread more to, yes, now I have to worry about my kids getting to school. Should they mask? Should they not mask? Should they be going to school? So all of that, there was really no getting away from it, which is really different than I was very, you know, yes, HIV positive patients, but here's what I'm doing. Go home. I'm not worried about it. My family is my family. My personal life is my personal life. I can go, you know, ride my bike and get away from it. So I think that that's a big difference in this, is that people have been less able to escape from that. And I think people are still, you can see it. It's not a big observation. The entire country, the entire world is trying to escape from this pandemic. So that's one thing that I think is different. The second thing that I think that Laura and I are doing is we thank people for staying with us and then say to them, now that they stayed with us, they can help bring people back in or new people on board and help create what we can create moving forward to really make healthcare the best that it can possibly be, given all the constraints that we have with the reality of healthcare in the United States. And then finally, that was something was mentioned at the very beginning when you're talking about the stress that everybody's feeling. And I was watching a series with my daughter and her husband, a show, I guess it's 6 or 8 parts, called Unforgivable. And it's around two women cops who identify a serial rapist. It's a very good movie, and it's a true story. But in it, my children, or these, my daughter and her husband, he's an orthopedic surgery second year resident, and she's a general surgery second year resident. But these two cops are talking, and they talk about the fact that you can't take the work home and share it with your family. And because of their jobs, you know, they don't really come home and talk about the sort of the horrible things that they would see from rape scenes and everything with their husband and kids. It's not what you do. And my daughter and her husband sort of looked at each other and kind of said, yeah, that's, except you can see how you wouldn't talk about that with your children. And I recognize in myself, and I would bet that Laura may recognize in herself, that you don't take the stresses of your job home to your family and decompress. It's not really a constructive conversation to have with somebody who's outside of healthcare and doesn't understand, well, why can't you just do this? And it actually can lead to a sort of escalation of the tension instead of resolving the tension. And that's something that I think is pretty common in healthcare. So then I think it's important to figure out how you're going to manage your stress around that, because you're not probably not going to be in a situation to go home and sort of decompress with your spouse. So it was an interesting thing in the movie, and it's an interesting conversation that my daughter, her husband, and I had about that reality.
Thanks for sharing that, and thanks for your reflections as well, Laura. It is difficult. Self-care in general is difficult. Sorting through vicarious trauma, learning to recognize it and deal with it. I have shared some of my own stories in previous conversations with the interns and with students just about being a forensic nurse. And there are a lot of areas of healthcare, not just one, that has those challenges, right? So learning how to manage is important. I want to just pivot for a minute here and think about the pandemic. We've talked a little bit about it. You've alluded to some of the strategies you've employed to lead and lead confidently in very uncertain times. Is there something, one thing maybe that jumps out to you that you've learned about yourself as a leader through this pandemic that perhaps could be useful to the other leaders listening to this?
Well, I've learned that the piece that Mark just shared about, you know, not always carrying it home and having some sense of boundaries about, you know, how you're going to do problem solving and really committing to caring for yourself is critical. And you need to do intentional work because you know what, everything else in your life fills it up if you don't. And one of the very best things that I did through the pandemic with my husband is that we bought a cabin up north. And being able to get away in nature, and not, you know, I felt very fortunate that I could buy a cabin, but it wasn't that. It was just being intentional about what am I going to do? How will we take care of each other? How will we take care of ourselves? How will we have something that we can have and share with our family? It was like, what can I do to make sure that that happens? Because that is a holistic part of me as a leader and just as a human being. So I do think the pandemic gave us a really important opportunity to do a lot of self-reflection, probably to the point of social isolation, but it also allowed for us to say, you know, what are those things that are important? And then what am I going to do to concretely make sure I can attain that or work towards that as a goal?
Thanks, Laura. Mark, any thoughts about one thing you've...
Yeah, I mean, I think that I totally agree with Laura. The healthcare, I used to say, you know, being a doctor, but it's really healthcare, but it's a jealous mistress was something that I was a comment that was made that I sort of adapted to healthcare. It constantly pulls at you. There's always more to do in the hospital. There's always more to do in the clinic. I've had other physicians tell me I don't set boundaries well. And when my daughter is a doctor, on a Sunday at 7 o'clock when the family was eating dinner, I got up and walked back to the back bedroom to, as my daughter said, yell at a patient for 45 minutes on a Sunday evening when I wasn't on call or anything else, but I'm talking to this patient. And my colleague said, I would never have that call. I would never have that call. I always had that call. I always answered the phone. So I have become better at saying, I've got to go do this now for myself. Mainly get on my bike and go for a ride. I never used to do that. And I've become better at saying, I just need this time for myself now. And this is my window of the weather and the daylight and all that. I need to go. And I have found myself coming back in a better place to then go ahead and do what I have to do. And before the pandemic, it was just work harder. You know, that time will come. Just keep working and slip in your enjoyment somehow on the side later. And then even feel guilty about it. So I'm better at not feeling guilty about it.
I appreciate that. And I recognize that for early career professionals, they might not be able to do exactly the examples you've given quite yet, but there are ways in which we can create some of those boundaries and be intentional about it earlier on in our careers. I have certainly some similar reflections about myself as well. Looking at the time, we have a few more minutes. Is there anything any of the participants would like to pose to the group at this point? I want to go back to one thing Laura said, and certainly Laura, you can pipe in. You mentioned the importance of people feeling they've been heard. Mm-hmm. And as a leader, I think about this a lot. And there are times when I'm on a Zoom call and I'm not, how many of you have done this? I have not given it my full attention. And there are other times when I am tuned in 100%, not just when I'm leading the meeting, but genuinely tuned in. And regardless of the two-dimensional nature of that conversation, I am making sure that person knows that they are the most important thing for me right then and there. But I don't know that I do a good enough job knowing that's, I'm not sure I'm confident that people feel they've been heard. So when you posed that and stated it, I thought to myself, how do we know people have felt heard, have felt cared for, have, and in the School of Nursing, we, at the University of Minnesota, we have employee engagement surveys. They're similar at almost any major organization. And one of the common points of feedback is, we don't want to just hear the survey results. We want to hear what you're going to do about them. And then we want to see that something's been done. So there's that follow through that perhaps is a piece of the evidence that we've heard people. But I wonder if you have any thoughts about making sure, you know, people actually feel heard.
Yeah. You know, and I'm, because it, this is interprofessional studies, I just want to say that sometimes it's even more challenging to feel like you're heard with interprofessional. And just because everybody comes with a different mindset or a different educational background. So I can't tell you how important this is and the work that you're doing. I really, really appreciate it, because having that sort of group would be amazing. You know, so I'm going to go back to nursing, and it's about closed loop communication and about read back. When I am really concerned about making sure that people feel like I've listened, that I've actively listened, or that their voice has been heard, sometimes I'll literally reflect back and say, you know, this is what I'm hearing, you know, does that really reflect what you were trying to express, you know? And it is all that stuff of how we were educated and how to make a difference in a conversation or dialogue. And, or I'll say, okay, what do you think I just said? And have them almost like read it back to me. And not in a way that's, you know, at all diminishing that I believe them, but just that everybody, especially with calls like this, it is easy to get distracted, and it is easy to like miss a really important point. And then, you know, you end up feeling like it didn't achieve what you wanted it to achieve. So those two things are really lifelong habits for me. And I know Mark is smiling because I do it to him a lot. I want to make sure that he knows his voice was heard, but, so that's what I would recommend.
So I think it's really important to not conflate being heard with getting what you want. A lot of our people think they're not heard because they didn't get what they want. My favorite chairman, the Department of Surgery, one guy was very famous for being very lovable, and he did a lot in San Francisco, and he's quite well known. And you never really knew what was going to come out of a conversation with him, because he was so fuzzy and warm and cuddly and nice, and he wouldn't do what you wanted him to do. And it's like, but my other chair, I'd walk in, he'd be yes, most frequently no, or I don't know, and I'll get back to you, just, you know, and I loved it. It was like, I mainly heard no, but I loved it. I've got to know. I know how I can move forward. So, but what we get a lot is this, well, I haven't been heard because I didn't get what I want. Well, I want to get paid for patients being seen in the ED. That's not going to happen. I want to stop losing money on every psych patient that we admit. that's not going to happen. I've been heard. And it's like, yeah, and we're not doing that. So those two things we have to keep separate. And the second thing, though, is, so Laura said, read back, and she does a lot. It's good. It's good. Closed loop communication. And we've seen a lot of examples of what people thought was said and what was said. And so we, you know, but the other part of it is, I was a nursery school teacher before I went to medical school. I taught preschool for 2 years in San Francisco. And there's a book called Parent Effectiveness Training and another book called Teacher Effectiveness Training. Very effective, very good books. And they give an example of when a child, say a four-year-old, walks in the kitchen and says, "What time is it?" at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. They don't want to know what time it is. They want to know when's dinner, because they're hungry, right? That's a really important thing to get to, is what are you really asking? Mm. And so there's a thing called a four chair drill, where you have people retell these stories, and somebody reads back the story. Okay, I'm hearing you saying this. Am I getting that story correct? And then another person is reflecting back their emotions that they are saying. You sound angry. You sound this or that. And the third person is trying to identify the unmet need. Because the unmet need is driving the emotions, and the story is actually completely irrelevant. And you can make up the story. It's the same every time. It's the unmet need that you need to help. And often the person who's telling the story doesn't know the unmet need. And so to get to that is a key. I mean, the closed loop communication is great, but also trying to say, what is the unmet need here? And it's a great drill. It actually can be kind of emotional. When I've had to do it twice, I've actually cried both times, which Laura will tell you I'll do it just because the sun came up. But it can be a revelation to say, I had no idea that was actually what was behind my emotions and the story. So closed loop communication is the easy piece. Not the easy piece, is a very important point to hold on to.
Thank you, and thank you for those stories. I was told by a therapist that an interesting exercise is to journal with your dominant hand, and then at some point journal with your non-dominant hand. And journaling with your non-dominant hand has the potential to tap into some emotions you might not be willing to experience while journaling with your dominant hand. I'm not sure if anyone has tried it. I have tried it. I end up sobbing and I have no idea why. It is, maybe it's because she told me that would happen, that I let it happen, but I was shocked at the pretty visceral response to that. So you could give it a try sometime. As we wrap up in the last few minutes, I would imagine that Laura and Mark, when you were young adults on your pathway, starting your careers, you did not necessarily know that you would end up where you have ended up. Do you have any pieces of advice or skills you might encourage those listening to invest some time in developing? Because again, they don't know where they'll end up either, but I know for myself personally, if I could go back, there's probably a few things I might develop sooner than I did.
You know, I think the best thing that I would say is trust and believe in yourself and believe in the process that your education is affording you, because it's helping you learn skills and beliefs and just all kinds of things that you don't necessarily know or realize right now until you're actually in some of the situations. And I think the other thing that was really important for me to learn is that you can't have so many expectations all the time for yourself. Life is going to happen. And you know what? Your best opportunity is maybe that improv, I can't even say the word, what Tina was saying about improvising. You know, maybe that's it. Just allow that to happen in your life and doors will open and close. And you know what? It will be what it'll be. And I think that that's a really important lesson to learn. And it doesn't reflect on you or the value of what you're going to contribute to society.
Thank you, Laura. Mark?
Yeah, Laura actually made me think about something that I actually think is what I would say. It's not a race. Mm-hmm. There is no finish line. I was in academic surgery for 25 years. I made active decisions that hampered my progression to being a department chair, which everybody thought I would be going towards. And those decisions were based on my family versus my career. And I chose my family over my career at every important juncture. Now, my wife would tell you I worked really hard and I wasn't, since I really so apparent to her, but I turned down a lot of opportunities because I was going to have to spend more time away from my family if I chose a promotion. And instead I moved closer to my family, moved away from those jobs. And I was slower in my successful career. I say that in air quotes for those of you that can't see. So there's no finish line though. You don't have to get across that successful career finish line at 42 or 45. I'm 65 and never would have predicted I'd be doing what I'm doing now, ever, 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 ever. In fact, if you had asked me, I would tell you this is torture in my mind. I'd much rather be in the operating room, helping patients directly. And this is, you know, sitting in meetings, quote unquote, doing nothing. That's torture for a person like me. But then before I realized I wanted to say that there's no finish line, I would say that practice, and Laura she's got a couple words that she uses for this, and I can't think of it right now, but practice respectful, empathetic, listening. Try to think about how people are where they are. And although Laura and I can both be quick to judge, if you can practice that, you can learn a lot. And then if you're in a situation where you're being challenged by people who may not be practicing respectful, empathetic listening, realize it's not personal. You know, don't take it personally. I think that that's something I still work hard on. It's not personal. But listening, although as I ramble on, listening empathetically is a way to grow.
Thank you, Mark, and thank you, Laura, and thank you to Senator Smith for joining us this evening. It's been a joy. I appreciate your candidness. I appreciate those listening and all of you for the gift of your time and your presence this evening.
Thank you for listening. Let us know what you gained from this conversation by writing a quick review. Please share this podcast with others, subscribe for future conversations, and check out our other episodes. Explore Health Sciences at the University of Minnesota at health.umn.edu.